Is there an ulterior motive behind the recent impeachment of Brazilian President Dilma Rousseff? Is there a connection between the NSA's spying of Dilma Rousseff a few years ago and current events? How is Washington likely to benefit from the present turmoil in Brazil? What are the prospects that the Workers' Party can be restored to power, perhaps under the leadership of former President Lula da Silva? Is the Brazilian government preparing a major reversal of gains for indigenous peoples and the environment? On this week's Global Research News Hour, in the wake of the political chaos sweeping Brazil, we speak to a prominent Brazilian-born geopolitical analyst and author, Pepe Escobar, about the deep political geography shaping current events in the world's seventh largest economy. Then we hear an interview with John Aniwanika Shirto about significant behind-the-scenes impacts on indigenous Brazilians. On this week's program, there is a coup going on in Brazil and the current government is illegitimate. A conversation with Pepe Escobar. Bringing you the analysis beyond the media headlines, the Global Research News Hour is on the air. Welcome to the Global Research News Hour for the week of May 20th, 2016. I am series host and producer Michael Welch. The Global Research News Hour is a special radio collaboration between the Center for Research on Globalization and campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg on occupied Anishinaabe territory on the homeland of the Métis Nation. We seek to provide you with access to analysis of the major issues shaping our world today, from thinkers, researchers, and unique political personalities rarely addressed by major media. Our program is available from the Center's website, globalresearch.ca. We can also be heard on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. We'll begin our show with News Notes, a sampling of articles from the Global Research News site. Institutional corruption is killing people's trust in our government and our institutions. Neither do Democratic or Republican parties represent the interests of the American people. Elections have become nothing but scripted beauty contests, with both parties ignoring the desires of their own bases. Indeed, America is no longer a democracy or republic. It's officially an oligarchy, and the allowance of unlimited campaign spending allows the oligarchs to purchase politicians more directly than ever. That comes from the article, "This U.S. Government is the Most Corrupt in History," by Washington's blog, posted May 18th. The expectation and demand is clearly that Russia must allow itself to be surrounded by NATO and to do this without complaint, and therefore also without taking military countermeasures, which NATO could call yet more, quote-unquote, aggression by Russia. Any defensive moves by Russia can thus be taken by the West to be unacceptable provocation and justification for a, quote-unquote, preemptive attack against Russia by NATO. That would be World War III, and it would be based upon the same accusation against Russia that the Republican candidate for the U.S. presidency, Mitt Romney, had stated when he was running against Barack Obama, quote, "This is without question our number one geopolitical foe," unquote. Perhaps the West here intends the final solution of the Russian problem. That comes from the article, "NATO Announces War Policy Against Russia, Chilling Scenario of Encirclement," by Eric Zeus, posted May 18th. In 2014, the authors of the report, "The Record of a Captive Commission," concluded that the outgoing Barroso II EC's trade and investment policy revealed a bunch of unelected technocrats who cared little about what ordinary people want and negotiate on behalf of big business. The reports state that the European Commission had a one-sided relationship with agribusiness on GMOs and pesticides. Far from shifting Europe to a more sustainable food and agriculture system, the opposite had happened as agribusiness and its lobbyists continued to dominate the Brussels scene. The report noted that the industry had been exerting strong pressure to prevent action by the EU on endocrine disruptors and pesticides. Failure to expose and challenge the corruption, lobbying, backroom, free trade deals, and revolving door that exists between agribusiness and decision-making regulatory bodies will result in these corporations continuing to prosper at everyone else's expense. That comes from the article Monsanto and the Poisoning of Europe, open letter to the EFSA chief attorney about relicensing glyphosate in the EU, by Colin Todd Hunter, posted May 18th. Obama now is going beyond mere sanctions to real military preparation for an invasion of Russia. On May 12th, Stuart Hooper at 21st Century Wire headlined, "New arms race begins. U.S. launches European missile shield in Romania." So not only is the U.S. placing nuclear missiles on Russia's borders, but it's also placing their anti-missile missiles to destroy outgoing Russian missiles that could be flying in retaliation against America's attack. And then, when Russian President Vladimir Putin responds to that type of aggressive move by his roving Russian forces to Russia's own borders to deter NATO's aggression, Obama and his propagandists blame Putin for threatening aggression against a NATO member. That comes from the article Obama Ratchets Up to Invade Russia by Eric Zeus, posted May 18th. On the 12th of May, a massacre was committed in the town of Al-Zara in the southern countryside of Hama, Syria. Women and children were slaughtered by Takfiri death squads branded by the Western media as moderate rebels. Western governments rant and rave about the necessity of military intervention to stop the massacres. This time there was silence. There is no benefit to the perpetrators of neo-colonial warfare and genocide in admitting that the terrorist is NATO, that it is actually the Syrian Arab Army that is fighting terrorism and not the Western military alliance. That comes from the article The West's Massacre of the Innocents in Syria by Gerard O'Kalman, posted May 18th, originally appearing at gerardokalman.org. The American aggression against China continued Tuesday, May 10th, with the invasion of Chinese waters just off the Spratly Islands by an American destroyer as China's limited stock of patience continues to run out. By sending their ships into Chinese territorial waters on the bizarre claim that they are exercising their right of innocent passage and that the United States will fly, sail, and operate wherever international law allows, they are, in fact, claiming the right to go anywhere they want, anytime they want. Logic requires that unless these provocations stop, there will be a shooting incident in the near future because there will be nothing else China can do. The thought of what could happen next can only make you shudder. But unless the world thinks hard about that and reacts with the necessary response, this renegade nation, the one nation that roams around the world with a big club, threatening, bullying, and destroying without regard for law, morality, or humanity, will push us all to the eve of destruction. That comes from the article American Aggression Against China, A World Crisis Looms, by Christopher Black, posted May 19th, originally appearing at New Eastern Outlook. These are just a few of the featured articles appearing last week on the Global Research website. Regular visitors to the site are encouraged to send monetary contributions by fax, mail, or online. Just go to globalresearch.ca and click Donate on the menu bar. Brazil's Dilma Rousseff has seen her presidency under siege for the last couple of years. 3 years ago, her personal approval rating stood at 79%. She emerged victorious in the 2014 elections. By July of 2015, following protests over alleged involvement in a corruption scandal, Rousseff's approval rating dropped to 9%, and her disapproval rating stood at 64%. The scandal known as Operation Car Wash involved the state-controlled oil company Petrobras and allegations the company's executives were accepting bribes from certain construction companies in exchange for contracts at inflated prices. Kickbacks would be used to finance electoral campaigns. Rousseff has denied any prior knowledge of the scheme, however. On April 17th, Brazil's lower house moved to initiate impeachment proceedings against President Rousseff over accusations she was manipulating government accounts. These were referred to as crimes against responsibility. The motion passed by a vote of 367 to 137. On May 12th, the Senate of Brazil suspended for a six-month period Rousseff's powers and duties as it deliberates on whether to remove her from office or acquit her for the crimes of responsibility with which she is charged. Vice President Michel Temer has assumed Ms. Rousseff's powers and duties and is functioning as the acting president of Brazil. Many critics, however, are suggesting that this constitutes a coup to serve internal and external powers. One of those critics is Pepe Escobar. Pepe Escobar is an independent geopolitical analyst who writes for RT, Sputnik, and Tom Dispatch, and is a frequent contributor to many radio and TV shows and websites, including Global Research. He's the former roving correspondent for Asia Times Online and has been a foreign correspondent since 1985. He's lived in London, Paris, Milan, Los Angeles, Washington, Bangkok, and Hong Kong, and was born in Brazil. He is, in his writing, he places an emphasis on big power geopolitics and energy wars and is the author of Globalistan, Red Zone Blues, Obama Does Globalistan, and Empire of Chaos, and his latest book is 2030. He joins us now from Ibiza, so thank you very much for joining us, Mr. Escobar.
Thanks, Michael. It's a pleasure to be with you and with everybody else, of course.
Now, we're hearing, if we could just maybe focus, first of all, on the official narrative that that we're being asked to believe, that that Ms. Rousseff has she's being accused of these crimes of responsibilities, what could be paraphrased as creative bookkeeping, and this has instilled outrage on the part of politicians and the broader public, and with demonstrations, and so there was a vote in the lower house which saw her this directed to the Senate, and then this recent impeachment proceeding that's playing out. I'm wondering if that's more or less accurate in terms of the official story, and maybe you could make any corrections there, because I suspect you have some concerns about what's really playing out. So,
well, Michael, concerns is the euphemism of the century. Let's put it this way. Yes, this is the official story, that Dilma has been accused of crimes of responsibility, which were never proven, by the way. This is what the Senate, in the next 180 days, when they are theoretically examining the merit of the whole question, it's their burden to prove that Dilma actually did some sort of maquillage, as the French say, with the budget. What actually happened, and Dilma has forcibly defended what she's done, these were not even decrees. These were everything that she did with the budget numbers was published in the official journal that comes out of Brasilia every day. So, and what she may have done, if it was masking the real budget deficit, her vice president would be implicated, so he would have to be impeached as well. But the whole point of this very sad, ghastly process, in fact, is related laterally to the car wash investigation that's been going on in Brazil for 2 years now, corruption inside Petrobras, the state oil giant, collusion between Petrobras executives, heads of powerful construction companies in Brazil, and politicians, mostly of the Workers' Party. This investigation has some merit, in fact, because the whole Brazilian political system is corrupt. And of course, there was a sort of a criminal cell inside Petrobras as well. But everybody profited from it, not only the Workers' Party in power, but different opposition parties as well. And the politicization of this whole investigation, in fact, from the beginning, it was obvious week after week, the way the judge, a provincial judge in southern Brazil, was conducting the car wash investigation, was taking a cue from the Money Politi investigation in Italy in the 90s, involving the mainstream media from the beginning. So it was basically a process of criminalizing people through mainstream media and only people from the Workers' Party, in fact. And the final target, the big prizes, in fact, two big prizes would be to get Dilma accused of something and to put Lula in jail. So they tried to put Lula in jail 2 months ago. It didn't work. When they were, Lula was more or less kidnapped from his home at 6 in the morning, taken from the to the municipal airport in Sao Paulo, put in a an interrogation room for 4 hours to answer questions that he had already answered before. And they were basically trying to kidnap him and take him to one of Brazil's southern states, which is the headquarters of the car wash investigation. And this sort of kidnapping coup at the last minute was prevented by some Air Force officers that were at the airport at the time. This is something that you will never read in Western mainstream media. The whole story was unearthed by Brazilian independent journalists. And I happened to be there at this fateful day in Sao Paulo itself. And I followed the whole thing practically live. It was one of the craziest political days of my 30 over plus story as a foreign correspondent. And I happened to be in my home country. So this was absolutely amazing. So this was the let's say, the coup against Lula. It didn't work. In parallel, we had an investigation, sort of investigation, in fact, an impeachment motion that had started in the Brazilian Congress. To give an idea, if you think that the Congress in the U.S. is corrupt, you ain't seen nothing yet in Brazilian terms. It's basically a gigantic lobby of, in Brazil, it's called the BBB. BBB stands for beef, which is the powerful agribusiness lobby, Bullet, which is the very, very powerful private security industry in Brazil, and also Brazilian weapons manufacturers. And the other B is Bible, very, very powerful evangelicals in Brazil, including the former head of the lower house, which was sidelined by the Supreme Court finally a few days ago before the impeachment in the Senate. So we had two parallel processes developing these past few months. The car wash investigation, which had put people in jail, some politicians, some were accused but not in jail yet, and some heads of construction companies. And in Congress, we had this impeachment motion that was fast-forwarded, in fact, by Eduardo Cunha, the former head of the lower house, which runs a political campaign scam or racket inside Congress himself. He is well-known all over Brazil as arguably the most corrupt man in the whole country. So you had this politician running an impeachment motion in Congress against a woman, president of Brazil, that was not formally guilty of any wrongdoing.
There's a saying that of the pot calling the kettle black, and that sounds like what you're talking about with Cunha and Rousseff.
Absolutely, and. From the beginning, some international observers, not correspondents in Brazil from mainstream media in the U.S. or in Europe, but some observers, some in the U.S., in fact, independent, some Russians, myself included, we knew what this was going on, and we knew that was absolutely crazy that Cunha himself was conducting this whole thing when he should have been in jail. He was found guilty of possessing 11 illegal bank accounts in Switzerland. He was mentioned in the Panama Papers. He was being already investigated for a racket, a netanol racket of $5 million that he probably got most of it in cash. He was accused by people left and right of receiving bribes in cash from the accusers. And obviously the Supreme Court didn't move against him. Their argument, the Supreme Court, no, we cannot interfere with legislative powers, which is completely absurd because nowadays, everything in Brazil, and in fact, it didn't start today, since the beginning of car wash, the whole process has been politicized. The judges are politicized. The prosecutors are politicized. The fact that only politicians from the Workers' Party were being accused, indicted, you name it. And in Congress and the Senate, the same thing. The base that's used to support the Workers' Party in both Congress and the Senate, they, when they saw an opening that they could have the vice president, which comes from another political party, the PMDB, in power, they defected from government. And that's why Dilma keeps telling that she was betrayed and these people are usurpers. They are usurpers.
Could you talk about the... You mentioned the Operation Car Wash earlier.
Yeah.
Do you see any connection with the, because any connection with what the charges of the NSA spying going back to 2013, spying on your cell phone and on other good government officials?
Of course, and this is something that you never get from CNN, from the New York Times, Washington Post, etc., and most of the European papers for that matter. The origin of car wash is the NSA spying on Petrobras and on Dilma personally, including her cell phone. And Edward Snowden at the time, and even later, he kept quipping that the Brazilians should know how to encrypt their technology, especially vis-a-vis the president. They were spied upon all over the place. And this was the basic information that later showed up at the desk of a provincial judge in a small southern state in Brazil. Why this guy? Very simple, because this guy was already an asset, Judge Sergio Moro. He had been invited by the State Department, one of those courses in Washington. So he was already an asset. He was remote controlled, obviously, from the beginning. And he was handpicked to conduct the car wash investigation. This investigation, because it was so huge, it should have been conducted by a prosecutorial office in Brasilia or in São Paulo, the two main centers, judicial centers in Brazil, not in a lowly southern state, by a lowly provincial judge. So this proves to everybody that this thing was politicized from the beginning. Of course, the fact that politics, because Brazil, unlike the West, lobbying, political lobbying is not regulated, it's a sort of a Tarantino-styled Wild West in terms of political campaign financing. So politicians, they go left and right, up and down to try to get some money. That includes state-owned enterprises. That includes private enterprises. And that includes what happened in the case of Petrobras and construction companies. Construction companies will get very good deals building stuff for Petrobras. And obviously there was a 5% that would find its way towards selected politicians, including Worker Party politicians as well. The corruption in Brazil political system, it's all over the place. It's in Workers' Party and especially all across the right wing opposition and the extreme right wing opposition.
Well, that begs the question. If I mean, you talk about corruption being so widespread, and I'm wondering if that understanding is fairly well known among the wider Brazilian population, that this isn't just a workers' party thing, like pox on all their houses or whatever. Do the Brazilian people understand that this goes beyond the workers' party?
Oh, yeah, absolutely. It depends, of course, what you mean by Brazilian. Brazil is an extremely complex country in socioeconomic terms. If we're talking about deep Brazil, what in Brazil is considered social classes C and D. You mean the poor, the lower middle class, the urban proletariat, and the poor, and peasants, let's put it this way. for them, everything that's that happens in Brazil or has happened in Brazil, linked or not linked to car wash, is it's a war amongst elites. It does not concern them, but they see it. They see the elites fighting among themselves. And obviously, the Workers' Party is part of this elite as well, because they are the party in power in Brazil. For the urban middle class in the more developed states in Brazil, in the Southeast especially, this is against, this proves once again that the Workers' Party is a bunch of lowly communists. They are corrupt to the core and they must be criminalized and sidelined from Brazilian political life. This is the view that you see in the global media empire, which in terms of concentration of power, concentration of media power in the global South is it's absolutely unheard of, and it's massive. It's it would be like comparing with US if you had NBC, ABC, CNN all together in one conglomerate controlling the airwaves, especially TV. And three or four major newspapers, two in São Paulo, two in Rio, that these are the so-called newspapers, the national newspapers of record, in fact. And most of the urban middle class and the upper middle classes in Brazil, they follow these papers, even though, of course, like everywhere else, circulation is declining, etc. All of these were pro-impeachment, pro-coup, and pro-car wash. So you can imagine, just to give you the perspective, Dilma was re-elected in November 2014. Since even before she was re-elected, her government, even before Dilma II started, end of Dilma I was already confronted too. Every day there was a scandal in the 8 o'clock nightly news, the global 8 o'clock nightly news, and in the big papers. Front page stories, day after day after day. So she was prevented from governing from day one, even before day one of Dilma II. And these two things were, the progress was in parallel, like you said in the beginning. The car wash investigation, which centered only on Workers' Party politicians, and the fact that Dilma could not more or less control or have a good dialogue with Congress. Congress in Brazil nowadays, especially under Dilma too, was a pool of sharks. And she was not a politician experienced enough or savvy enough to know how to control these people. Lula was. Lula has always been a master politician, a master negotiator, and he knows Brazil like nobody else, with all his faults, of course. But he knew how to control Congress and Senate, allocate a favor here, a favor there. So basically, the Workers' Party and their main coalition partner, the PMDB, could actually run the government. Dilma was inexperienced enough and too closed on herself. She was not a she was never a dialogue person. She was too authoritarian. She wanted to run the economy, and she doesn't know much about economics. So much of what happened to her later on, she brought upon herself. But that also, we always have to consider the fact that she is not guilty of any wrongdoing. Okay. Very, very important. So car wash went after Lula, blaming him for dodgy wrongdoings, like he owned a seaside apartment and a ranch in the state of São Paulo, when in fact he didn't. He got kickbacks when he was in a lecture circuit all across the world, and this was proved to be completely bogus as well. And against Dilma, they had nothing. So they had to come up with, when I say they, it's an alignment of the BBBs that we spoke of, these three very powerful lobbies inside Congress, parts of the judicial system in Brazil, at least half of the Brazilian Supreme Court, which is heavily politicized, like it is in the US, for instance, and mainstream media. So these four very powerful actors were trying to, okay, we tried against Lula, it didn't work. Let's go after Dilma big, big time. And then later on, we go against Lula again. And that's exactly where we are at the moment.
You're listening to the Global Research News Hour, broadcast out of Winnipeg on campus community radio station CKUW 95.9 FM and on the Progressive Radio Network at PRN.FM. We are also podcast on the website globalresearch.ca. You say that basically the United States has been acting behind the scenes to kind of instigate this whole affair, and I think you used the term hybrid war in reference to this whole situation. I was wondering if you could explain, if that is the case, what are the principal motives of Washington in this drama?
Exactly. It is. I wrote about Brazil being the most sophisticated hybrid war phenomenon so far. It was a mix of slow motion coup, impeachment, or as the Brazilian creativity denominated it, golpeachment. Golpe is Portuguese for coup. So this neologism perfectly explains that. It was a slow motion golpeachment, not directly linked to a corruption investigation car wash, but mounted in parallel and in secret inside Congress. So you had parts of the judicial system giving the go-ahead for the impeachment to proceed. Congress and Senate working together to ensure they had the numbers so impeachment would pass in both houses. The mainstream media from the beginning selling that the country was dead, paralyzed, paralyzed, Dilma was over, and they had to go through the next thing without analyzing the merit of the question if she was guilty or not. So all the major actors are more or less aligned. Your question is the heart of the matter in geopolitical terms, of course. Cui bono? Who profits from all this? Well, now there's an enormous list of grievances that Washington had vis-a-vis Lula and vis-a-vis Dilma. The two Lula governments, the first Dilma administration and a part of the second. The most important is the famous Bill Clinton question, it's the oil stupid. It's the pre-salt deposits that were discovered by Petrobras themselves with Petrobras indigenous technology without help of any of the oil majors from anywhere, US, Canada, Europe, the Chinese, Gazprom, you name it. These reserves are, conservative estimates that these reserves are worth $8 trillion US dollars. The problem is Lula, before he left, he ensured that Petrobras would be the sole exploiter and seller of rights, you name it, of these reserves. This for American big oil is an absolute anathema, as we, all of us know. Not by accident, the guy who's now the Brazilian foreign minister, José Serra, which is an absolutely appalling character and a sore loser as well, a senator. He lost a presidential election to Lula, and he's trying to come back ever since by lateral means, not by direct elections, because he'll never be directly elected to anything in Brazil. He promised to Chevron 4 or 5 years ago that if there was any sort of upside-down situation in the Brazilian government, Chevron and obviously ExxonMobil will be in for the spoils related to pre-salt. So the oil question in all this is absolutely paramount. Number two point is BRICS. BRICS, as you know, is a very, very dirty world in the Beltway, not only in Washington and the Beltway, but in Wall Street as well. And the fact that China, dethroned the U.S. as the main trading partner in Brazil, the fact that Lula and then Dilma had very, very good, and they have very good relationships with, especially with Putin and Xi Jinping in China, the fact that there is a closer partnership between Brazil and Russia, and now a strategic partnership between Brazil and China, and lots of Chinese investment all over Brazil, This also for Washington is absolute anathema. So one of the key moves for this interim government at the moment is to try to de-link Brazil from the BRICS and relink Brazil with American interests, especially. And also Mercosur, UNASUR, the Union of South American Nations and the South American Common Market. This is not a priority for the right-wing interests and for these interests allied with Washington. And the fact that, of course, that for years, while the U.S. was involved in wars in Iraq, in Afghanistan, they forgot about South America. So there was this pink wave all across South America. The Workers' Party is not a red party in the Chinese sense. The Workers' Party was always pink. They even used neoliberal practices. But Lula was always very clever because he had his set of priorities from the beginning. Let's try to make this country less unequal. It's still one of the most unequal countries in the global South. And even more important, because it's the seventh largest economic power in the world, let's make this more unequal. Let's have 30, 40 million people who have always been excluded become at least part of the middle class in Brazil. And little by little, we'll be tackling all problems that are related to inequality. This is something that Dilma was supposed to do, and she never managed to, because there was the global the commodity crisis all over the world. Brazil didn't have a plan B. The plan A was always to sell commodities, especially to China. There was not enough investment in education from day one in Brazil, including Lula. But Lula always said, look, we don't have enough money to do all this. First, I need to get these people out of poverty. Second, I'm going to invest in education long term. So there are some good educational policies put in place by Lula and by Dilma, but these are long term. You're going to reap the rewards in one generation from now. So it's a very, very long term process. So these gains will all be reversed if this interim government lasts more than 180 days. Yeah, okay. And this will be one of the things we're going to discuss pretty soon. Is this government going to last, or is this going to last until the next presidential elections in 2018? And this is exactly it's what Washington is betting on. Because to revert most of these social conquests by the Workers' Party and especially the international foreign policy alliances of Brazil, you cannot unravel all this in 2, 3, 4 months. You need at least 2 years, 2.5 years, in fact, until 2018. Assuming they will have their candidate winning the elections in 2018, which is a big if.
That's very interesting. I'm curious to know, looking ahead, you're expecting that Lula will be will contest the 2018 election. And the question of what do you anticipate will be the outcome, or for that matter, what do you see happening as this whole drama unfolds over the next couple of years? Is it looking bad for Brazil, or is the fight back going to be successful?
Well, bad doesn't even begin to explain it in terms of the poorest Brazilians who, their constitutional rights are being attacked as we speak. And it's not only the fact that, for instance, they canceled the Ministry of Culture, and then the 2 or 3 days later, because there was even an international uproar about it, okay, we're going to have it back, but we need a woman to lead it. They invite 5 Brazilian women personalities, they all reject it. So the Walking Dead interim government is already there. It is Walking Dead for all that matter. The problem is how long this thing is going to last. These next 180 days are going to be crucial, because for Dilma to be impeached for good, they need 2/3 of the votes in the Senate. It's not clear as we speak that they have these 2/3. Some people who voted for impeachment in the previous Senate vote, they are already changing their minds when they look at what this government has managed, in fact, has managed to not accomplish in 5 days. they took the country back at least 50 years in their 5-6 days in power. It's amazing. They, for instance, they have a ministry of the new minister of industry. He goes on record saying that I have no experience in industry whatsoever, apart from the fact that I was an accountant at the start of my career. It's beyond Kafka, but with very seriously tragic overtones to all of it. The fact that they're planning to cancel social programs in terms of help for the needy, construction of popular housing all across Brazil. The fact that they are antagonizing their neighbors, Bolivia, Ecuador, Venezuela, via exactly this guy who wants to basically take the bee out of BRICS. The fact that, for instance, there was during the Cannes Film Festival, the crew of one of the Brazilian movies being shown at the Cannes Film Festival, they went live with a protest while they were climbing the red carpet, and this was caught by cameras all over the world. So now, everywhere all over the world, people know that there is a coup going on in Brazil, and the current government is illegitimate. By the way, nobody anywhere for this past week, their first week in power, recognized the current interim illegal government in Brazil. Nobody. Obviously, the U.S. Tersely, via the State Department, has said that Brazil has, you know, the usual platitudes, a strong economic fundamentals, is a strong democracy, blah, 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 blah. So they are more or less endorsing what's going on without totally endorsing it. And the Russian foreign minister already said that there has been foreign interference in Brazil, which coming from Moscow, it's pretty, pretty strong diplomatic language. The Chinese haven't said a word. And as far as I know, they are following it very closely because they're expecting Dilma to talk to them directly and explain what's going on. After all, this is this is BRICS, and they have a summit later this year as well. And the BRICS, the leadership in the BRICS, they are not going to recognize these people in power in Brazil. The problem is the internal political situation in Brazil is so complex, and it changes every 24 hours. So nobody has a crystal ball to say whether this illegal interim government is going to last the 180 days, including during the Olympics in Brazil. Which is, I'm sure, Brazilians, poorer Brazilians, working class people, artists and intellectuals, and even sportsmen in Brazil, they will be denouncing this illegal government during the Olympic Games in Rio. Hmm. So this is going to be an extremely embarrassing situation for Brasilia, like 2 months from now, right?
Yeah.
And obviously, long term is, there are two main objectives related to the car wash investigation and the impeachment process. Number one is to get over with Dilma. We can say that they more or less accomplished the first stage. It's going to be very hard for her to be back in power. And if she's back in power, she has to sell the nation a program for the rest of her mandate, which she doesn't have as we speak. And the number two objective is to criminalize Lula and to get rid of Lula, because these aligned powers that we were discussing a while ago, their number one obsession is Lula cannot run again in 2018, because they know, and all the recent polls have said the same thing, if he runs, he wins. And then everything that happened since the re-election of Dilma, November 2014, including car wash, impeachment, impeachment, etc., would be for nothing. And because Lula, back in power in 2018, he will have a more streamlined, corruption-free program to sell to Brazilian society. And deep Brazil, especially the poorest part of the country, they will buy it.
Mm. Well, Pepe Escobar, I want to thank you very much for this very pertinent analysis and your unique insights into this whole drama, and certainly look forward to reading more of your articles in the coming weeks. So thank you very much for joining us on the Global Research News Hour.
Thank you, Michael. Look, we barely scratched the surface. This is one of the saddest political stories in modern times. And obviously, all of us all over the Global South, we have to follow it very, very closely. Okay. Thank you.
Thank you. We've been joined by Pepe Escobar, independent geopolitical analyst. He writes for a number of outlets, and much of his articles are compiled on the Global Research website. Political turmoil currently underway in Brazil is having an impact on the indigenous population of the region. To tell us more, we're bringing back John Aniwanika Certo. He is the Winnipeg-based editor and publisher of Intercontinental Cry, an online media hub for news and analysis of indigenous struggles around the world. Thank you for joining us, John.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, so I guess first off, I wanted to just bring up briefly, there's a story here of the Climate News Network reporting about indigenous and environmental laws that are being rolled back as a result of this bill, PEC 65-2012.
Yep.
And it's apparently going to act as a boost to infrastructure projects threatening the ecosystem. And this is all happening amid the or being largely eclipsed by what's happening with the Dilma Rousseff impeachment. So I was wondering if you might be able to just explain briefly what you see as the practical outcome of the passage of that bill, and given some of the infrastructure and industrial work being pursued in the country.
Well, first, I think it's noting that it's worth noting that it's a significance to see this bill being pushed forward right now in the midst of everything that's been going on with Rousseff and the quick movements of the new governments to, push Brazil in the direction that is beneficial for industry and the rich in particular. But this particular bill, proposed Constitutional Amendment 65. Would allow major infrastructure projects to go ahead regardless of their impacts on biodiversity, indigenous lands, and conservation areas. For example, the Belo Monte Dam, which is currently on hold because of the failure of the government to consult indigenous peoples with regard to the impacts, could now just be simply dismissed under this law, and project could just steamroll ahead, and that could be the case for every other project in Brazil. So it's definitely a major concern, and I think it's a signature of what we can expect to see with this new government while it's in office.
On your website, they announced a landmark win against hydro dams on indigenous lands in Brazil, and the FUNAI, F-U-N-A-I, decision protecting Munduruku lands from the development of a hydro dam destruction.
Yes.
And do you see that being rolled back in any way, or is that fairly?
Well, yeah, it could be if the government now decides to. The FUNAI, which is the government agency responsible for creating policies and laws for indigenous peoples and representing indigenous peoples' interests in Brazil, formally recognized the Munduruku's lands, which protects it from this hydro project. But it's not expressly official until the president signs off on the project. Rousseff probably would have done so because of the Munduruku's very militant stance. Like they're committed to physically, sacrificing their lives en masse to defend their territory. And the Rousseff government obviously wouldn't want to have blood on its hands, at least not directly. So it would have likely signed off on the demarcation or recognition of the Munduruku's lands. But now with Temer in office, who knows? My inclination is to believe that he'll just say, well, who cares? They're just Indians. But, I guess we'll have to see what happens here.
Yeah. Well, could you talk about this, the FUNAI? You seem to have expressed some concerns to me about this group being shut down. That's not confirmed at all, right?
No, it's just rumor at this point. FUNAI was established in 1967 in response to a 7,000-page report by the Figueredo Commission, which was tasked with investigating the atrocities carried out by the Indian Protection Service, which was at the time the government agency responsible for indigenous affairs. SPI's original mandate was to assimilate Brazil's indigenous peoples, but the agency graduated, I suppose you could say, into a genocidal beast. For over 40 years, the SPI carried out an endless line of crimes against humanity, including mass murder, genocide, torture, enslavement, bacteriological warfare, mass sexual abuse, and land theft. Now, this key report, exposed SPI's brutal legacy to the world, resulting in the dissolution of the SPI and the creation of its predecessor, which is FUNAI. So it's not just, I often describe FUNAI as the Brazilian equivalent of Indian and Northern Affairs, and it is in many respects, aside from the fact that it also represents, it's a symbol of the of a shift from the genocidal mentality that existed to one that's a little more human or mature, responsible, and the fact that FUNAI could now be axed with the level of racism that exists in Brazil, I think is something that everybody should be very concerned about, and I know indigenous peoples in Brazil are concerned, and they're watching very closely to see what steps the government takes here.
This report you mentioned, it's somehow been covered up or subverted?
Well, that's an interesting story actually. The report was lost or believed to be lost in a fire. The report was there was only one copy of the report. It was never made public. Before it could go public, the offices of the SPI burned to the ground mysteriously, and so the report was thought to be lost in the fire. And as it turned out, though, that wasn't the case. But unfortunately, because the report was lost, the SPI was never legally held responsible for its actions, and the dozens of government agencies that were identified in the report were never held accountable. The entire history was just basically swept under the rug. Unfortunately, though, it turns out that the report wasn't lost. It was actually discovered in 2013 in the SPI's old building, which in the 70s, 1970s became, or maybe it was the 80s, became the Museum of the Indian. Unfortunately, the museum was actually scheduled to be destroyed for the World Cup. It was going to be mowed down for a new parking lot, but before the government actually moved forward with it, somebody went through the old building, which is, falling apart in some areas, and, found in some corner in some room the report. Unfortunately, there was one chapter in the report that was missing, but, probably about 6,500 pages of the report were sitting right there in boxes. So the report is now being reviewed by various agencies in Brazil. I'm not sure if it's been made public yet, but hopefully some copies have actually been made, so that the individuals can be held accountable, because this all happened in this legacy ended in the 1960s, 1970s. So
yeah, 50 years.
So everybody's still around, and the racism that existed from those days also very much still exists.
So what kinds of protections are there for indigenous peoples in Brazil beyond individual human lives? Are there protections for them as a people?
There are constitutional protections. There are actually very strong protections for indigenous lands. I don't know the details. I only know the outcome. There was one ruling in a few years ago on the in the area called Raposo Serra do Sol, where non-indigenous peoples had invaded the territory over decades and were pushing the indigenous peoples off their lands. So the court ruled in light of the constitutional protections of indigenous lands that the non-indigenous inhabitants had to vacate with compensation, but they still had to leave because they were occupying the land illegally. And, you know, impressively for all the difficulty that the Brazilian government has had over the last while, even going back to Rousseff's predecessor, you know, Da Silva, he ordered the government to obey the law, and as a consequence, they, you know, forced the non-indigenous inhabitants off the indigenous land. And I think that's actually an incredibly rare thing for a government to do. Like, not even Bolivia or Venezuela have gone so far to protect indigenous lands. So it was a remarkable win, and there have been other instances of that happening as well in Brazil. So I don't know any specific laws that are protecting indigenous peoples. You know, there has been a sentiment to protect indigenous peoples and indigenous lands on the you know, government floor, to an extent at least. You know, like with the like that's not the case with the with the Congress, which is controlled by the very powerful agribusiness lobby in the country. And what I mean by powerful is if you combine the tobacco lobby in the U.S. and the oil lobby and the beef lobby and the chicken and egg, you know, lobby, combine them, and that's the strength of the agribusiness lobby in Brazil. You know, they own Congress, and what they want usually goes forward. Mm. And one of the things they've been pushing really hard for is another constitutional amendment called PEC 215. And this would give Congress the unprecedented power to control the legality of indigenous lands in Brazil. That's that power usually rests with the president. So, for example, the Munduruku lands that were just recognized by FUNAI, if PEC 215 goes forward, Congress could either reorganize the borders that FUNAI defined for the Munduruku, or it could just, you know, toss out the claim altogether. So, you know, that's and that is actually expected to be passed within the next couple of weeks, despite the fact that indigenous peoples have been, you know, organizing routinely for over 3 years to prevent this law going forward. You know, and they've done a good job lobbying against this project, you know, considering the fact that they're pushing against the agribusiness lobby. But now it seems like their efforts may have been in vain. But of course, I don't think Brazil's indigenous peoples are going to take this sitting down. You know, there is a very strong indigenous movement in Brazil, and we're already seeing signs that that they're not actually going to sit idly by. That they're going to push and push hard. Possibly even organizing on the level that we've seen in Colombia and Ecuador over the last decade or so.
Well, John Chertow, I really appreciate this update on the situation in Brazil, as depressing as it seems in some respects. But thank you very much for sharing it with us.
Certainly.
We've been speaking with John Aniwanika Chertow. His website is intercontinentalcry.org.
You've been listening to the Global Research News Hour. You can listen to our programs every week on CKUW 95.9 FM in Winnipeg and on partnering radio stations across Canada and the United States. We are now also broadcast on the Progressive Radio Network at prn.fm. You can also download each episode from the website globalresearch.ca. To leave feedback on this program, email globalresearchnewshour@gmail.com. I'm series host, creator, and producer Michael Welch. Join us again next week.